That's the spirit.
Professor Peter Lynham.
How are you today?
Good, mate. How are you?
Excellent, thank you.
Now, there's been some kind of significant event.
There surely has been. The 100th anniversary of the armistice, which took place at 11 o'clock on the 11th. Although it has to be, 1918, has to be said that when we commemorated it at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning in New Zealand, we were perhaps a little bit ahead of ourselves because presumably it didn't happen until...
We're early.
Yeah, I would have thought we were probably 12 hours early, but there we are. These times are just symbolic times, and we'd have to work out whether they had daylight saving back in 1914 for a start, if you're going to get fussy. So it is still a huge, huge event, because I don't know, have you been anywhere near the museum and seen the display of the
crosses? The crosses. I have seen those. I'd found that quite... interesting. Actually, a lot of people were sort of soaking that up as I was. I just sort of every once in a while I'll do a shortcut through there to get to Parnell for burger fuel or something. But I did. It looks gnarly.
It's profoundly disturbing in some ways. You think
it's a lot of crosses. Yeah.
Yeah, 18,000 crosses.
And to explain to anyone out in the grass there in front of the museum.
They're in front of the museum.
All that
and
grass.
And there's a cross for every person who died in World War One, with war wounds.
Mm. And they're actually even mini. They're actually small, but it's still, I guess they had to
be. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And on the side, they have specifically arranged those where two died in one family, and then there's a relatively small group where three died in one family. And there's actually one cross set aside by itself where four brothers in one family died, which is a pretty horrific thought, isn't it?
That's crazy.
An appalling sign of just the disgusting way in which the war authorities couldn't really care less of the consequences on families. They just went ahead with their conscriptions. Remember that this is the first major conscripted war where from 1916 in New Zealand, you were balloted. Mm. Your name was balloted to report in. And so it created a whole new culture of people who were required to be in the army, and it created a new group of resistors of those who declined to report. So you get conscientious objectors come about as a result from that.
Yeah, couldn't you break your arm or something to not go?
There was a medical examination you had to pass as well, but you'd have to report in, and that was the doctors within the army who would certify that you were incapable of doing that.
Okay.
So it was an extraordinary event.
But patriotism was still real back then, eh? It was pretty like...
In a way, a new kind of patriotism emerged, and it's really interesting. I was in a service last night where I objected to singing the words, "I vow to thee my country."
Right.
But you see, that was the notion of World War One, that patriotism had to become a matter of individual fervor. The country, in effect, became greater than any other loyalty to family or to religion or to anything else that might get in the way of it.
Right.
Because, people had to be willing to die for the state. Now, why would anybody choose to volunteer to die for the state? Well, because you can get people fervent to do anything if
the fear is strong enough.
Propaganda enough.
Yeah,
yes, that's right.
Yeah, I often wonder what would happen. You know, I guess it depends on what you're facing as to what you would do. You know, it's hard to say. Your fight or flight, in a sense. That's kind of where we're at.
It's crazy when you put it into the perspective of the size of the New Zealand population at the time. 18,000 people is
out of a million. Out of a million people.
Of a lot of people.
It's a huge number of people, and it's interesting because in the early months of the war, I've done a lot of reading of people's sort of diaries and comments, and there was this enormous enthusiasm and the belief that the British were invincible. Mm. Of course, the Germans felt exactly the same way. But by 1916 and 17, with no end in sight, there's a kind of fatalism, and yet they still go ahead. Very, very few people start popping up their heads and saying, what's the point of this? They just ride with it. And it's a strange thing, because you would argue that by then it clearly was stupidity. Whoever imagined that a mass slaughter was going to be any good for anything? And you think of the ways in which, I mean, the whole global economy was wrecked, especially the European economies, by the impact of that. And, I mean, there would have been no World War II without a World War I, literally, because, I mean, the grievances of World War I produced World War II.
Right, right, right.
I think even more than that, there's a hugely significant change that comes about, because when they went into the war, I mean, it really was, in a way, an aristocratic cause of war. You know, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand is assassinated. And so people are fighting for empires, and they're fighting for dynasties. And at the end of World War One, well, the British dynasty survives because it didn't lose, but the Russians, the Austrians, and the German dynasties all collapse, you know. And so the world changes. And I think probably religion changes a huge amount as well, because a lot of the kind of old fervent faiths now seem to have failed in some respect. And ordinary soldiers are pretty skeptical about the way in which religion is used to keep people loyal and to make people be prepared to march into battle and die.
Yeah, like, your God's the real God, you know? You're fighting for the right God.
Yeah, precisely. And by the end, you can see a certain degree of skepticism in the average soldier. And certainly it's very striking in New Zealand that after those soldiers come back to New Zealand, there's a very, very sharp drop in male religious attendance. And especially in the more evangelical churches. And that probably reflects on the degree of, you know, the soldiers who come back and really aren't prepared to go near. They've had enough of religion.
Fuck,
really.
How can you believe anything after seeing that kind of stuff, you know? Like,
precisely.
What man's capable of is quite...
Yeah, that's right. And, of course, a fair degree of shell shock and wanting to forget the stuff. It's very interesting the way in which people... many of the returned soldiers would not talk about the war after they returned. It was like it was almost a private trauma that they'd been through, and they couldn't endure discussing it with anybody else. So you see, there's a huge turning point in global society, or certainly Western society, but probably also in a lot of the imperial, you know, places like India as well. A lot of the Indian resistance to British rule comes about because they play a role in fighting the forces, and yet they're not allowed to go to the Western Front because it would seem disturbing to have coloured people fighting the Imperial War.
Whoa.
Just quickly, Peter, so Armistice Day on the 11th November 1918, does that mark the official end of the First World War, or was it just a bit of a breather?
No, it was the official end of the war against Germany and Austria. Now, there were some bits and pieces of war that carried on being fought against Turkey and just bits that didn't get tidied up immediately. And so you quite often see in war memorials, I was asked about one yesterday, and somebody said, why on earth does it show on this monument that World War I, 1914 to 1990? And that's because, in effect, an armistice is not the end of the war. And there were still bits and pieces to be tidied up. But in effect, almost all the fighting ceased in 1919. One or two sad people died because people kept shooting, didn't quite understand they would have stopped shooting at that point. And, I mean, the tragic story of some New Zealand soldiers who die in the hours before the 11th, 11 a.m. and the 11th of the 11th. But, yes, it was... really all the powers exhausted, and then critically the arrival of the Americans into Europe tipped the balance decisively in favour of the Allied forces.
Hey, Peter, I hate to compare because it's ridiculous, but it does interest me as to like the sort of the attendance or like the or what people are going to and what they're what they're remembering. Whereas like the Anzac situation is probably the stronger one of these occurrences. Would you agree or what?
Do you mean which of the two world wars?
Yeah, or just what, how we have our days that we remember, right?
Yes,
which one's
yes.
out front? It would be Anzac, wouldn't it? Because we seem to be closer to that one.
Yes. Yeah. In New Zealand, Anzac Day is vastly bigger than the Armistice Day. In most of the European countries, well, in Britain and France, the Armistice Day is the day used to remember World War One.
Right.
In New Zealand, of course, it's a strange thing because Anzac Day is about defining identity. It's the original New Zealand National Day, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But in Europe, that's not the way in which they're thinking about it. They're thinking about it the end of something that destroyed an era.
Right.
And so the Armistice Day, that's not what we choose to remember, because actually the self-definition of New Zealand came about with Gallipoli, even though that was really quite a side campaign in the overall warfare. So there's a bit of a difference in the way it feels.
Got you. Interesting. Okay. Hey, thanks, Peter. That's great. It's always a pleasure, mate. And we'll do it again next Monday, yeah?
Excellent. Very good.
Perfect.
Bye.
Do you want to?